Hi, everyone. My name is Beverly, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank Jack and the committee for inviting my husband and I here. I'm very honored and proud to be sharing with you here on your 13th Bluff City Convention. So again, thanks to the committee. Now, as I said, I'm very proud to stand here before you this morning and tell you that I am a sober woman alcoholic, because this was the case a little over 25 years ago. I stood in a mental institution at that time, and I had been out on one of these little day trips they let you out on occasionally if you've been on your good behavior. I hear some of you have been there, huh? And anyway, it was aboard a fishing boat, and they were serving a little booze aboard the boat that day, and needless to say, I had a few. And by the time I got back to the hospital that night, I was quite drunk. And when they finally allowed me to go back up on the floor, you know, we had one woman in there that was fairly new, and I was immediately attracted to this woman. I mean, she was just like my sister. And she was being treated for something called alcoholism, and I didn't know what that was. But anyway, when I went up on the floor that night, she followed me into my room. And she looked over at me and she said, "Beverly, I think you're an alcoholic." Well, I want you to know I have never been so insulted in my life. And I told her in no uncertain terms that she needn't lay her thing on me, that by God, I was crazy. You know, and the sad part of it was is that I really meant it. I had rather been called crazy than to have been called this thing an alcoholic, whatever it was. In fact, I was so insulted that as soon as I could see my own doctor, I told him what Lenore had to say to me. And I said, "Now, Dr. Valentine, what do you think about that?" And he looked over at me and he shook his head and he says, no, Beverly. He said, "If you can just learn to face reality, and if you can just learn to cope with some of these problems you have, I can't see where you have any problem with alcohol." Well, hell, he was the boss and it sure sounded right to me. So anyway, I was to continue drinking for another 3.5 years. Now, I want to back up here just a little bit and give you a little bit of my background. As you can probably tell, I don't speak English. I speak Southern. And at least that's what they tell me in my home group. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here because some of y'all have that funny little accent too. Anyway, I come from a little town in Florida, and I have two older brothers, and I don't particularly remember the occasion, but I remember Daddy had said to us when we were kids, he says, "Now, when you kids are old enough to go to work and earn your own money so that you can buy your own cigarettes and your own booze, as far as I'm concerned, you're old enough to drink and smoke." Well, hell, needless to say, I went to work at a real early age. And along about that same time, the war came along. And for you young people that are here, that was the Second World War, not the first one. You know, get that one straight right off. Now, by the time, you know, I hear a lot of people saying, well, they drank for a lot of reasons. You know, I don't remember drinking for any reason other than, you know, when that Second World War came along, it was a real popular war, and it was just like the whole world had gone on a party. And hell, all I did was just join the party. Only thing was, is when the party was over, I never went home. Now, I still haven't gone home from parties. I'm still a party girl, you know, and I like it that way. But anyway, by the time I was 16, I was a blackout drinker. Now, I was also pregnant and married, just in that order. Now, today, hell, if you got to get married, I guess getting pregnant's as good a reason as any. But, you know, in the days when I was growing up, nice girls didn't do those things. Now, would you believe me when I want to tell you that I was almost 4 months pregnant before I even knew I'd been had? I kid you not. The way I found out was I was doing waitress work at the time, and I'd wait on a customer, and then I'd go throw up, and then I'd go wait on a customer, and then I'd go throw up. And the boss was standing back there watching the action, and he came over and informed me he didn't think it was too conducive for good business and suggested that I go in and see a doctor. So I did. I figured I had the flu, and I went in, and we had family doctors then, and he examined me, and he said, "Now, Beverly, when you finish dressing, I won't see you in the office." "No, fine, you know, that's normal." And I went in there, and He leaned back, you know, these chairs they have in their office, you know, and he leaned back and he crossed his arms like this and he looked over at me and he said, "Beverly, you're pregnant." Well, I thought about that for a minute. I just leaned right back over the table and I said, "Dr. Moses, I can't be. I've never been with a man." He leaned back over the table and he looked me right straight in the eye and he informed me I was not the second Virgin Mary. I was real sorry to hear that. Anyway, I did marry this young man, and there are two things in that marriage that was really important. Because you see, it was in this It was a real drunken type of a marriage. This man, I remember the doctor told me he was an habitual drunkard. Now that was, we never heard the word alcoholic or alcoholism at that time. He called him an habitual drunkard. But one of the things that happened in that marriage, I lost that first baby, by the way. But one of the things that happened in the marriage, he came home one night and for whatever the reasons, he struck me across the mouth with a full bottle of beer. And the last thing I remember, I was spitting teeth and blood. And the next thing I knew, I was on my knees in front of the bedroom door, and I had the black handle of a butcher knife in there with just a little stub on that knife. And I looked up that door, and there were two parts of that knife in that door. And it just scared the living daylights out of me because I had tried to kill this man, total blackout, I had tried to kill him. And in fact, without recognizing what I was doing, I made a commitment at that time that I would never, ever get angry again because, you see, getting angry meant I might kill somebody. Now, I did have another child 6 years later. I waited 6 years because I found out what caused it. I didn't quit doing what caused it, but I just, you know. Anyway, I had gone to the doctor again with my nose sitting sideways on my face and my eye all swollen up. He looked over at me and he said, "Beverly," he said, "you really ought to leave this man." He says, "He's an habitual drunkard." And he said, "One of you's going to kill the other one if you don't." So I thought about that. And get this, I left him, not because I didn't love him, but because I did not want my child raised in that kind of a drunken atmosphere, little realizing where I was to end up at. Anyway, I did what we in Alcoholics Anonymous here sometimes call doing a geographic. Now, in some circles, that's really known as unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Anyway, Mama sent me a one-way ticket, and I went out to California. And when I got out there, I picked up on what I called my social drinking. Now, one other thing happened from that marriage that I want to share with you, and that was, as I said, I still thought I loved this man when I left him. And I spent the next 2 years rocking, crying, and cussing and praying because I hurt so bad. And again, without realizing what I did, I made another commitment that I would never, ever love anybody that much again because, you see, love caused too much pain, and I never wanted to have to hurt that bad again. So at a very early age in my life, I had buried two of the strongest emotions that a human being can have, and that's one of anger and one of love. Now, I'm a very slow learner, but when I learn my lessons, I learn them well. And one of the things I learned in that marriage is you don't go to bed with a man first. You marry them first. And as I said, my baby was about 6 weeks old when I left him, and I got to tell you, by the time she was 4 years old, it had been a long, dry summer. I kid you not. And I decided this child needed a father. And I met this young Irish Catholic boy. Now, hell, we all know all Irish Catholics are alcoholics. They're all here, you know. I married the only one in the world, I think, that didn't drink. Now, I don't know how I managed that one, but he didn't drink. And we hadn't been married for just less than a year, and he come home and found me in my usual state one time, because, you see, I was in the throes of alcoholism at this time. And I remember he stood there, and he looked down at me, and he said, "Beverly," he said, "I just can't take this anymore." And he said, "You're either going to have to give up that drinking, or I'm going to have to go." Well, I said goodbye to Paul. And Mama and I were back together again. Now, I got to tell you about Mama, because Mama was real important in my sobriety. And, you know, when you walk into AA and you get into clubhouses, at least in California, we usually have a bunch of cliches up around the walls in clubhouses, like Easy Does It and First Things First. Well, I knew all about cliches when I got to AA because my mama used to have them, and she used to say them all the time. And I remember that one of hers was, if you don't succeed at first, you try again. And, you know, and as I was coming out of my second marriage there, Mama was coming out of her fourth one. Well, you see, Mama just didn't say cliches. She lived them. I mean, she believed in them, you know. And anyway, we had gotten home from work this evening, and I just put the baby to bed, and we were sitting in the living room, and she looked over at me, and she said, you know, Beverly, she said, I think we ought to get ourselves some kind of a business, you know, to ensure Charlotte, my daughter, a more secure future. And, well, hell, it sounded like a real good idea to me. And I had a little bit of cash, and Mama had a AAA credit rating, so we did. We got a business, a liquor store. And I'm telling you, the fun really began. Because you see, what I haven't told you is my mama was an alkie too. And anyway, I was a moving drunk, and what was beginning to happen at this time was that I had to keep drinking in order to keep moving. And I was into the morning drink. Along about this same time here, what happened was that instead of going from sick to well, I was going from sick to drunk again with that morning drink. I just wasn't getting off of it. And anyway, along about this same time, I fell in love again. Well, what I really did was fall in heat. But I didn't recognize it as such at the time. I called it love. And anyway, this young man introduced me to a thing called the barley sandwich. You don't know what a barley sandwich is. Okay, let me tell you. A barley sandwich is beer and tomato juice, and that way I was getting my booze and my vitamins at the same time. And what it was doing, it was sort of sliding me back into the day again. And anyway, I did marry this young man. You're looking like it doesn't taste good. I got to tell you, it didn't. But you see, I didn't care how it tasted. It worked. And that was all I was interested in, was did it work? Because by this time in my life, alcohol had become the only consistent thing I had going for me. Jobs came and went, husbands came and went, friends came and went, alcohol was consistent. And anyway, I did marry this young man, and oh gosh, I guess about a year or so after we had been married, and he was a real drinker like I was, and We did a lot of partying and entertaining and all that good stuff that we alcoholics do before we get into real drinking. And anyway, I began to have some kind of funny symptoms. At this time also, we'd been married about a year or so, and he kept saying to me he wanted me not to drink so much, and he wanted me to drink like a lady. Well, hell, I was drinking like a lady. You know, I never fell off of a bar stool to my knowledge. I fell a few times getting up on one, but never off of one that I... And anyway, I was trying to taper off because Mama was on my back a little bit too about that time. And for some reason, shortly after that, I began to have some kind of funny symptoms. I remember one morning I got up to go to work and I was making up the bed and the bedspread was wet and I couldn't figure that one out. Hell, I didn't have a drink in there with me. You know, I looked around, I couldn't find one. So I felt up underneath to see how the mattress was. You know how you are by the time you get to that stage and you're drinking and the mattress was dry. And I thought, well, now damn, that's funny, you know. But I had to go to work. I was a moving drunk, so I went on into the bathroom to get myself ready. And I looked up in the mirror, and it was just like somebody had turned on two water faucets. I wasn't crying, but the water was just pouring out of my face, you know, and I didn't even know it. And I thought, well, damn, boy, that's funny. But you see, I had a fixer, and so I just went on into my bar and poured myself a couple of hookers, and, hell, the water just shut off, and I just went on in and finished getting dressed and went on to work. Well, when I got home from work that afternoon, I walked into the living room, and right in the pit of my stomach, it started shaking. And the next thing I knew, I was just jumping all over that living room floor. And, I mean, it scared the hell out of me, you know. And I just thought, well, I got my fixture if I can just get in there to it, you know. And I finally got myself jerked around in the right direction and hopped on into the bar in there, and I had one of these big brandy glasses, and I thank God for that. And anyway, I finally got something poured in that, and I got my face down in it and started laughing it up, you know, because I couldn't pick it up, and, you know, when you're jumping that hard, and I couldn't, you know, hold anything in my mouth. But anyway, I got a couple of those down me, and finally, you know, I began to calm down. Now, I got to tell you, drunk or sober, if there has been anything in my life that causes me to take an action that's been either fear or pain, drunk or sober, fear or pain will cause me to move, to take some kind of an action. Well, I went on, you know, because, hell, I calmed down, and I thought, well, now, darn, you know, that's kind of funny. But you know how we women are. You know, we're scarlet O'Hara. Hell, we'll think about it tomorrow, you know. I ain't got time today. And anyway, I went on in the kitchen, fixed dinner, you know, and kind of put it out of my mind. Now, a few days later, I came home from work, and I remember laying down across the bed, taking a nap, and the next thing I knew, I woke up, I was on the floor. I had wet all over myself. I had mucus all in my hair. And I vaguely knew that this was not the first time something like this had happened. But I knew what it was, because I had a couple of friends who had had these things when I was young. And anyway, I was scared. I was really scared this time. And I went on into the bar and poured myself a couple of hookers. And for you young guys here, I'm not talking about the two-legged hookers now. I'm talking about shot glasses. That's what we used to call them when I was a kid. And anyway, I poured myself a couple of hookers and drank them, and the fear was still there. And I had a couple of more, and the fear was still there. And I thought, well, damn, I better call a doctor. So I did, and I went over, and they run me through a whole bunch of tests and stuff. And what they decided that I was having was epileptic seizures. Huh, Paul? You've had a few of those, too. And anyway, they run me through some more tests, and they decided that I was in the midst of a nervous breakdown with all this stuff, and that was how I got to UCLA up on that fifth floor in that NPI section, the nut ward, you know. But anyway, it was there that the first message of Alcoholics Anonymous was carried to me. But as I told you, when Lenore told me this, she also told me that she had tried this thing called AA three different times, and it didn't work. You know, and that was the message that I got there. But I was to continue to drink for another 3.5 years. Now, you've heard about that moment of clarity, and I want to share with some of you my moment of clarity. I was in this same house that I am in today, in Chatsworth, California, and I was sitting there waiting on the then husband to come home. Sound like I got a little problem there? I do, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit. Anyway, and he was about 4 or 5 hours late. Hell, we girls know where these husbands are when they're 4 or 5 hours late, don't we? Yeah, they're out with her, the one who understands them. And we know about them, too, because some of us were some of those who understood them. Oh, dear. Anyway, my daughter was away for the weekend, and he finally come home, and he looked over at me. I couldn't help it, you know. I had waited for that man as long as I could, and I had a supply, because he was marking the bottles by this time, and he had even stooped so low as to shut off the CO2 on the beer on tap. But I didn't worry about it. Now, as I said, him and Mama both had been on my back, so I had found this little hiding place. Now, there are some of you in this group tonight, I'm sorry to say, that's going to be a scout. And some of you may be female scouts. And I can see by that blank look that you don't know what a scout is. Let me tell you what a scout is here in AA. You've seen these old pictures of the wagon trains, these Western movies of the wagon trains coming out to the West, you know. And in all these wagon trains, they always have a scout. And that scout goes out ahead of the wagon train, and he looks out there to see if there's any Indians and to see if it's safe to proceed ahead. Well, that's what a scout is. And they have yet to come back and report it safe. But anyway, if you're a scout and you're a female scout, and this is strictly for the girls, boys, I got to tell you about this hiding place I found that they never found. They found all the rest of them, but they never found this one. And when I first found it, it was a little box about this size. It was a 12-size pack box, and I could get a half pint in it. And by the time this night came along that I'm telling you about, I had graduated to the 48 size box. I could get two fists in that one. One on each end, and that way I had one coming and one going all the time. I never had to worry about making that run right in the middle. And what that was a box of Kotex. I sure hope with all these new things they've got out today that they're still making that size box. And, you know, sure be a waste. I hope I'm not going to be offensive to anybody here today, but, you know, this is the way it happened, and this is where it was. But anyway, I went up and had myself a couple of drinks, and just about this time he come home. You know how we are. We never have more than two. If you ask us, you know, it's always just a couple. And he came home, and he looked over at me, and he said, "Beverly, you're drunk, and I'm not going to take you anywhere." And with that, he just went off into the bedroom and passed out. Now, I sat there, and I thought about that for a few minutes, you know, and I... Finally, after I went over and I fixed myself another drink. And I remember walking up into the house and looking out through the kitchen windows. And there were two new cars sitting in that driveway out there. And I walked through my home and I looked at it, and it was a brand new home. And it was beautiful. It was the kind of a home that if you opened up the book of the Better Homes and Gardens, you would see my home in that book. And I walked on out into the backyard, and it was well manicured. You know, it was the kind of a yard that belonged to the home, that belonged in the book of the Better Homes and Gardens. And when you looked at us as a family, my daughter and him and myself, we were the kind of a family that belonged in that home, that belonged in that yard, that belonged in that book of the Better Homes and Gardens. You know, that's what we presented to the world out there. And I remember standing there in that yard that night and looking up and saying, "Why, God? Why now, when I've got everything that I've always wanted, why do I want to die?" And you know, I couldn't have told you that night, but today I can. What good is all you've got if there is no joy in it? And you see, alcohol had taken all the joy out of my life, and it had taken me into a living hell of which I could find no way out of. And I think that it was Christ that said something similar to that when he said, "What profits a man who gains the world and then loses his soul?" And you see, I had lost my very soul through alcoholism. Now, I went on back down into the rumpus room, and I fixed myself another drink. And as I sat there with that drink in my hand, thinking for the first time, out of the dark recesses of my mind, it came right out there and it hit me. And it says, "Beverly, I'm it. I'm the one that's taken you to where you are today. And you can't let go, honey. I got you." Well, at the same moment that I realized I couldn't drink anymore, I knew I couldn't drink any less. And what do you do when you find yourself in that predicament? Well, I did the only thing I knew to do. I killed myself. Now, I say that facetiously, but when I woke up 3.5 days later, I was in a place called County General Hospital, which was quite a few miles from where I lived in Chatsworth. And I had tubes out my nose, my throat, both arms, and both ankles. And I'm laying there, and I'm wondering, where in the hell am I? And there was a policeman standing over in the doorway. And I looked at him, and I said, "Where am I?" And I said, you know, and he looked down at me, and he had the most disgusted look on his face. And he said, "You're in County General Hospital." And I said, "Well, how did I get here? I live in Chatsworth. We have insurance. We have money. How did I get here?" And he looked over at me and he said, "Lady," he said, "committing suicide is against the law." Well, now, I didn't know that. I remember telling this one time in one of our home groups there, and we have one of our members who sits on the appellate court, and he came up to me after the meeting, and he said, "Beverly, you just gave a beautiful talk, but," he said, "I'd like to make one little correction for you, if I may." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well," he said, "committing suicide is not against the law. It's attempting suicide that's against the law." Well, that made a little bit of sense to me. And anyway, it was through that my psychiatrist sent word to me, and he said, "Beverly, want to see you." And I did. I was released under his care. And I went up to his office, and he looked at me, and he said, "Honey," he said, "you need help, and you need it desperately." And he said, "I can't help you. But he said, while you were in the hospital this time, he said, I went to some open Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I liked what I heard there. And I've read their literature, and I liked what I read. And he said, here is the number. Will you call them? And I'm sitting there while he's going through all this, and I'm thinking to myself, well, you son of a bitch. You know, I've been coming to you for 3.5 years, as many as 3 times a week at $60 a whack. I darn near killed myself and drank myself to death, and you're sitting there telling me you can't help me? You know, something was wrong. But I didn't say it. I didn't say it. And so I told him I would, knowing it wasn't going to work for me, but I did. I got home, and I called Central Office. And this woman had answered the phone. She said, honey, are you having a problem with your booze? And I said, Lord, I sure am. She didn't ask me if I was an alcoholic, and I'm grateful for that because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And anyway, she said, well, are you drinking right now? And I looked around, and I didn't see anything around. I said, well, no, not right at the moment. And she said, well, can you hold on for a little while? I'd like to send a couple of women out to talk to you. And I thought about it, and I said, well, if you'll make it quick. And so anyway, you know, she said she'd send them, and I said, okay. So, you know, I got to thinking while I was waiting on them to come. I run around the house and got it all spiffied up, though. You know how we are, you know, and I got myself all dressed, and I'm thinking there in the meantime while all this is going on. And I couldn't hardly wait for them to get there so I could tell them about that son of a bitch I was married to, you know, so they'd know why I had to drink like I did. Well, they finally came, and you know, every time I'd open up my mouth to talk about him and tell them what he had done to me, they'd start talking to each other. You know, now, I never got a chance. They were there for over 2 hours. I never got a chance to tell them anything. They were so self-centered. All they did was just talk about themselves. And finally, when they got finished, I guess, you know, talking to each other, they turned around and looked at me as they stood up, and they said, by the way, Beverly, we're coming by to get you at 8 o'clock. Now, you be dressed, honey, you know, and we're going to take you to a meeting. They never even asked me if I want to go. Yeah. Well, anyway, I was ready. They came, and we went. Now, from now on, I'm going to start talking about this book, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a book written by alcoholics, for alcoholics, about alcoholism and how the alcoholic is to stay away from the first drink. And I'm not up here to tell you what you have to do. I'm up here sharing with you the things that I had to do and that I learned from this book. Now, when they took me to a meeting, I kept hearing the word, get a sponsor, you know. Well, I did. And, you know, she was one of those kind of sponsors that says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. She was a whip. I kid you not. We was, you know, in this meeting, they also told me not to try to identify with how much, how often, or where, or when, you know, people drank. But, you know, what alcohol did to them. Where did it take you, Beverly? Well, as I said, it had taken me into a living hell. So anyway, I'm in these meetings, you know, and this sponsor had also told me, she said, Beverly, she said, you know, if you need to ask a question when you're in a meeting, you come to me and check it out with me first. I said, okay. And she said, if by accident there's somebody new there leading the meeting, or you know, and by new, they meant somebody 5 years or older. She said, and they don't know who you are, and they should call on you to share in a meeting. She said, you stand up, and you give your name, and you state your illness, and then, honey, you sit down and shut up, because that's all you know. Now, I come in when they were real mean in AA. And anyway, so I did. I wasn't allowed to talk in a meeting, and that was fine, because I was very scared anyway. Y'all talked about things I didn't know nothing about. A lot of wisdom, but I didn't know anything about it. But anyway, I had a question one day, and I went to her, and I checked it out with her, and she says, well, now, what is this question? And I said, well, I want to find out how to stay sober, because now I've made the decision now that I am an alcoholic. And she said, well, okay. And she says, what's the questions? And I said, well, I want to know how to stay sober. And she said, well, okay, you can ask that question. So I did. I went to a meeting, you know, and I asked them, Well, these people were so involved with each other that they never had time to answer my question. They talked about going to a lot of meetings and not drinking in between meetings, you know, and reading a big book and getting a lot of telephone numbers and about their neighbor's dog shitting on their lawn, you know, and all these really important things, you know. But nobody had any time to talk to me about how I stayed sober. And I don't care what meeting I went to them, you know, and I asked that question, and the people were all the same. You know, it was go to a lot of meetings and don't drink in between meetings and read the big book, you know, and get telephone numbers and call them and the neighbor's dogs, you know. And, you know, and finally I went to her. I was so disgusted. And I told her, you know, I said, I just don't understand it. I can't get an answer to my question. And she says, well, let me ask you something, Beverly. How long you been sober now? And I said, well, I don't know. I guess it's about 7 or 8 weeks, something like that. And she says, well, how you been staying sober? And I thought about that for a little while, and I said, well, I've been going to a lot of meetings and not drinking in between meetings and reading the big book, you know. It was so simple, it just went right over the top of my head. I didn't hear a word y'all were saying, but yet I was doing it. And anyway, you know, I remember we were at a meeting one time, and it was after the meeting, and there was a group of us women sitting around and sitting there talking, and I know that what I did was I must have threatened her with I was going to get drunk. Have you ever done that to your sponsor? You know, I mean, let's keep them in line, huh? Okay, so I threatened her. Anyway, she looked over at me and she says, let me tell you something, Beverly. She says, if you decide to get drunk, I want you to know I'm not responsible for that. I thought about that and I said, well, okay, you know. And then I must have said something else, and she got up and left the table. And she had taken a few steps, and she come back and she looked down at me and she said, I just remembered. She said, but you're suicidal too. And she said, if you decide to commit suicide, I want you to know I'm not responsible for that either. Well, I looked up at her and I said, well, what the hell are you responsible for then? You know, they got to be good for something. And she walked over to me and she picked up my big book and she stood right over the top of me and just hit me right across the bridge of my nose here with it. And she says, I'm responsible for helping you to learn what's in this book and how to apply it to your life. Well, I said, okay, you know, if that's the way she's going to be. Now, she also told me one day, she said, Beverly, you look like a woman and you dress like one and occasionally you talk like one. But she said, I don't think you know what it is to be a woman. And she said, I want you to go to some women's stag meetings. Well, now, I thought that was asking a little bit much, you know, and I told her, you know, there ain't no way you're going to get me in with those gossiping, backstabbing bitches. She said, you go. I went. Now, when I got there, I found there was some gossiping, backstabbing bitches in there. However, what I also found was some very warm, wonderful women who literally saved my life. Let me tell you about the wisdom of these women. I was sitting in one of these women's stag meetings when I was still new, and I was really having a problem because, you see, I had sobered up in September, and I was very concerned about what I was going to do on Christmas morning. Because we always opened a bottle of pink champagne every Christmas morning, and we couldn't open our presents until we drank that bottle of pink champagne, right? Now, I didn't know how I was going to manage to do this, and so I asked this question in this women's stag meeting I was in, and I got some real good answers. I know that one woman said to me, well, honey, just stay in bed until it's all gone. And that sounded like a good idea. And another woman suggested, well, honey, why don't you have your husband get a bottle of this non-alcoholic champagne? Well, I thought that was an even better idea. And then this other smart-ass woman in there, and she looked over at me and she said, well, honey, just don't drink it. Well, that had never occurred to me. I mean, you talk about wisdom. Now, that's wisdom, you know. Anyway, I was going along here, and my sponsor also told me, she had this book, and she opened it up one day and grabbed it out of my hand. You see, I always carried my book with me from the time I got sober, and I'll tell you why I did, because I was a kind of a drunk that I always had a bottle with me somewhere close by, either in the back of a car, you know, or in my purse or whatever. And I had it with me for a real good reason, because I was afraid if I didn't have my bottle, I just might get struck sober. So when I sobered up, I always carried my book, because I was afraid if I didn't have it, I just might get struck drunk. Not that I'm superstitious, but anyway, she looked over at me one day, and she grabbed my book out of my hand, and she picked it up, and she said, "Honey," she said, "on this first page," and the first page is a blank page in the book, and she wrote across here, "emergency page," in red. And she said, "Now, when you go into meetings and you hear a woman talking," and she specified woman, I don't know what her problem was, I'll tell you. And she said, "You go up to them after the meeting if you like what they've had to say and the way they're living." And she said, "You get them to write their name and their telephone number in your book." And I said, "Well, okay." So I did. So I had me a page full of numbers there. But she had also said with that, she says, "Now, if you ever decide to drink before you take that first drink," she said, "you call someone." So one morning about 10 o'clock in the morning, for God knows for whatever reasons, I decided I was going to have to get drunk. And then I remembered what she told me, so I ran in and I grabbed my book because I wanted to get it over with quick, you know, so I could go on about my business here getting drunk. And I started dialing, and we didn't have push buttons then, it was finger dialing there. And I looked on that page and I called the first number. Well, the line was busy. So I thought, well, okay, so I dialed me another number, and that line, you know, there was no answer. And I thought, well, darn, you know, no problem. I had a page full of numbers. Well, so I dialed the next one, and she was just on her way out the door and didn't have time to talk to me. Well, I dialed that whole darn page full of telephone numbers, and not one of them had time to talk to me. But you know the most amazing thing happened. By the time I had gotten finished calling all those numbers, I forgot what the hell I'd called for, you know. And beside that, it was time for a noon meeting. And what I'm trying to tell you is that if you will follow the directions, it will work. It does not matter how it works, it works, if you follow directions. Now, she had also grabbed my book again at another time, and she opened it up to that second blank page, and she wrote across that emergency page. And she said, "Now, Beverly, as you read this book," she had come over to the house one day, and you know how we are when we're new and we first get into AA. You know, I got home and I put all the literature out on around on the coffee table and the end tables, you know, and I'd got my big book and I'd laid it right up in the center of the coffee table, you know, where everybody could see it. And she was over at the house this day and she reached over and she flicked the dust off of it. And she picked it up and she says, "Now, honey, now that you've bought the book, I want you to read it." Well, I mean, hell, you know. Anyway, so she opened it up that particular day, and she wrote across this other page, emergency page, and she says, "Now, Beverly," she said, "as you're reading the book, and you run across something that's important to you," she said, "I want you to underline it." I said, "No, no, we don't mark books. We're all taught that at a very early age." She said, "Underline it." So I did, you know, I marked it. And she said, "Then go over here on this second emergency page here, and you write down the number of that page and a little short synopsis about what's on that page." Now, I remember calling her up one time, you know, and God, I was just really into it, and I just knew I was going to drink, and I mean, I was just running around there like crazy. And I called her up, and she said to me, "Honey, read the book. The answer's in the book." Well, have you ever tried reading the book when you're flying up your own ass? You know, there ain't no way. But let me tell you why they tell you that, because I know you've got a sponsor that tells you this same thing, right? They don't know where the answer is in the book. It took me 5 years to learn that, so I'm really giving you some good information here today now. Anyway, you know, that's where I was there, and so, you know, that's what I did like she told me to. Well, you know, I've got a pet peeve, and I want to get that out right now. You know, I hear people in meetings, and they say something like this: "You can work this program any way you want to. If you be an alcoholic of my kind, and somebody says something like that to you, for Christ's sake, run." We hear it read in every meeting back in California. It's in chapter 5. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. One path that does not say to me that I can work this program any way I want to. It says there is only one path. Well, hell, I knew all the answers when I got here. It was the questions I didn't know. And I began to learn what the questions was. Now, what is that path? Did you ever ask yourself what that path was? Well, I got back in this book again because she kept saying the answers were all in the book. And what I found in there, it says something like this. A lack of power is our dilemma, and to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what this book is all about. Now, they're going to use words in there like exactly, precisely, absolutely. And they're going to go on to say it even gives clear-cut directions. Now, that really doesn't leave any room for the fertile imagination of an alcoholic to run around in. I mean, you know, it gets very specific here. And here I was. So that was the path. To find a power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem. Well, now, I didn't want to hear that because that meant God, and I kept hearing y'all use that word, and I thought, that ain't going to work. I know, I've tried it, I've gone to many different churches, and that didn't work. But you remember again, I said that fear and pain were two things that motivated me, drunk or sober, into taking an action. And along about this same time that I'm thinking, God ain't going to work, I remembered a little something I'd heard as a kid, and it went something like this. I would rather live my life as though there was a God and die and find out that there wasn't than to live my life as though there was no God and then die and find out that there was. That put a little bit of fear in this kid, and I'm telling you, I decided to do what you people had said when you said act as if. And so I started acting as if there was a God. And then you started talking about a word called spiritual. And I thought, oh, Lord, here we go again. You know, back into religion. And it just simply is not going to work. Haven't you people ever tried this religion? It don't work. There was too many Catholic priests and other ministers in this church, you know, in this program here. And, you know, and y'all ought to know by now that religion was not going to work. And this sponsor had also taught me to use the dictionary. You know, well, it's very difficult because I tried using the dictionary when I was a kid and I had a hell of a time with it because if you don't speak good English, you know, you can't spell it very good if you spell by phonics. And I had a lot of trouble trying. If you can't spell it, how are you going to look it up? You know, I had a terrible time with that. But anyway, she had taught me to use the dictionary and I did. I looked up the word spiritual. And what I found in there for me that helped me in the beginning was the definition that it gave. It says, spiritual is an elevation of thought and feeling. That's simple. Just simply an elevation of thought and feeling. Well, from the kind of a drunken woman I was when I first got here to you people, when I set aside that alcohol, I automatically had an elevation of thought and feeling. Now, it went on to say right after it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path, and then where it said a lack of power. You know, and I know that a lot of newcomers don't like to hear that. A lack of power is our dilemma, and to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what... Like it or not, this is a spiritual program. And that's it. And you might as well accept it or go on back out there, you know, and see if it works. And when it doesn't, you can come on back in here and we'll do it again. Anyway, I was in this. And then right after that, it says, we have written a book which we believe to be moral as well as spiritual. Now, I don't know what that means to you, but I can tell you what it meant to me. I don't think that my drunkenness was a moral issue. However, I do believe that my sobriety is. And I felt that I had darn well better find out what my morals were. And so I did. Now, I was married when I first got here to you people. And my sponsor had been, you know, teaching me a few things, or at least talking to me about a few things. And one of the things that she had said to me was, honey, I want you to get a good, firm foundation of this program. And she says, I don't want you to make any major decisions for at least a year. And she said, in your case, you're sicker than most, so I want you to wait 3. I kid you not, that's what she told me. And I was. And then she said, you know, and I don't want you getting emotionally involved. Well, I had no problem with that one because I was married. When I'm married, I'm married. When I'm single, now that's something else. But anyway, I was following along with this. But by the time I got to be 3 years sober, I had finally made that decision to get a divorce. And that was the way it was for me, and I'm not advocating divorce. But anyway, she had also added a little addendum onto this when she was teaching me, and she said that there is a clubhouse in this valley, and it's called the Owl Nest, and she said, I want you to stay away from there because there is some dirty old men there helping women with their spiritual program. Now, I didn't have any problem with that one. I didn't care about going up there because I'm married. Well, you know, when I got that divorce, where I went. Sure you do. I'm not dumb. I got up there at that Owl Nest, and I'm telling you, I was just like a kid in a candy store. And I sat there and I looked around and I said, I'll have him, and him. You know, oh my God, I'm telling you. But you know, the minute I found myself doing that, I knew I was in trouble. I was in heat again. Now, I know that y'all aren't going to believe this, but I have found since being here, I don't care whether you're 9 or 99, a man, woman, or child, that when we come into this program, we have two problems, and that's bad breath and a broken heart. Booze and sex, if you will, in plain language. And here I was, and this secondary problem had cropped up, and I was terrified because I'm in heat, and I'm, and I don't know what to do because I figured if I got laid, I was going to get emotionally involved. And if I got emotionally involved, I was going to end up back on the juice again. And I just didn't know what to do. I was in terrible straits here. Now, I know that some of you guys out here have been told the same thing that I was told, you know, is that you don't want to get involved with these women. Now, you old timers, I know, have said this. Because behind every slip, there's a skirt, right? You girls needn't laugh, because behind every slipper, there is a zipper, too. And I knew this, you know, and I knew I was in trouble. I just, you know, I was in a heap of trouble, and I didn't quite know what to do about it. But you see, I'm 3 years sober now, and my mind is beginning to think. God help you when you start thinking. And I had begun to pick up some babies along about this same time, and I was teaching these babies the same things that I had been taught, you know, is that you get a good, firm foundation. You don't make any major decisions for at least a year. And you don't get emotionally involved. And then I changed it just a little bit. And I added a little thing onto it. And I said, but honey, if you need to get laid, that's all right. You see what I figured? If you could get laid without getting emotionally involved, you could come back and tell me how, and then I'd be okay. You know, makes good sense to you too. I can see that, you know. But the only thing is it didn't work. And you guys need to sit there and laugh, because I ain't seen any of y'all, you know, that's got laid without getting emotionally involved. You know, I don't find that y'all are any different than we are, although I certainly used to think so. You know, when I first got to this program, I always thought it was poor little Nell that was the one that was always mistreated by you mean old men. And I've come to find out since being here for a little while that these poor little Nells, some of them are barracudas. And that you men do not walk away from some of these relationships scot-free like I used to think you did. I used to think that you had no problem with this. Didn't bother you at all. But since I've been married to a man on this program, I've had the privilege of holding some of you in my arms as you cried about some of these little relationships that you've practiced some of your principles in. And anyway, you know, I was sitting in this Owl Nest, this same clubhouse here, one time, you know, when I first started going over there, and I was talking about how submissive and subservient I was when I first got to this program. And I really was. I was such a people pleaser, and especially to the men that I was married to, and whichever one he was at the time. And anyway, there was this guy in this meeting, and, you know, and I couldn't stand him, you know, and he looked over at me. He couldn't hardly wait till I got finished talking. And he finally, you know, when I finished, he raised his hand, and they called on him. And he looked over at me, and he says, "You know, lady," he says, "I don't know what this submissive and subservient is," he says, "but if you stop and think about it," he says, "really all you was just a kiss ass." Well, now, I'm telling you, when he put it in that kind of language, I want you to know that I've never been submissive and subservient since. I mean, he took all the glamour out of it, zoom, just like that, you know. And but that's all right, because, you see, I got even with him. I married him over a little over 17 years ago, you know. But anyway, I'm sitting in this meeting, you know, and I know I'm in trouble, and I know I got to do something, and you know, and it just ain't working, you know. Y'all pardon me, but I just got to tell you this. There was this little dog, and he lived with a family that lived up by a railroad track on this little hill. And he got up this one morning, and he looked out the window, and it was kind of a day like it is today, you know, and the wind was blowing and the sun was shining, and it was a gorgeous day out there, and he wanted to go play. So he gave out a couple of yips, you know, and he scratched on the door, and finally his owner came over and he opened the door and let him out. And the little dog went running up on the railroad track on this little hill where it was, and he was running along the railroad track, and he was sniffing the weeds and sniffing the flowers, you know, and his little ears were flying back behind him from the breeze, you know, and he was just having a marvelous time. And all of a sudden, this train come along and cut off a little tiny weeny piece of his tail. Well, that little dog lit out a yip, and he turned around to see what happened to that little tiny piece of tail, and a train came along from the other direction and cut off his head. Now, honey, don't you be like that little dog and lose your head over that little piece of tail. I just had to get that in there because that's where I was at. I see y'all never been there, huh? Okay. Anyway, here I am, and I'm just scared to death I'm going to get drunk, and I got this terrible problem, you know, and I don't know what to do about it. Well, you know, girls, let me tell you, because in the big book, it also talks about, you know, that we are reborn. And I got to tell you, I have found this out to be true. We girls, when we get here, we are reborn, and I don't care from what walk of life you come from, if you have been the biggest streetwalker out there, when you come into AA, you get a chance to start your life all over again. You are now a virgin. And if you don't believe me, you watch these men watching these newcomer women. They can't hardly wait to be the first one, right? Oh, boy. When you men are going to start getting well is when you're going to want to be the last ones in these women's lives and not the first one. And when you're going to start making improvement in your program is when you want to love the hell out of these women instead of the hell that's in them, you know. Now, that's improvement. And I want to tell you girls something, too. As I said, I found out that these men do not walk away from these relationships scot-free. They hurt. Just like we do. So let's us try to be as honest and as gentle with them as we want them to be with us. Okay, and so these are just some of the things I learned. But I'm still in heat, and I'm still in trouble, and I know I got to do something. And so what I did was, because my sponsor said the answers was in the book, I went over here to my emergency page, and I opened it up on that second blank page there. And I looked to see what page the answer was on. First page number I had written on my emergency page. Sure, you know what it is, page 69. I couldn't believe it was a dirty book. That's where my problem was. Well, I got to tell you, the answer's in there, because if you'll turn that page over, no pun intended, you're going to find the answer on page 70. It says in there, if we are truly sorry for what we have done and have asked God to take us on to better things, we believe we will have been forgiven and will have learned our lesson. But if we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink again.
We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our own experiences. It scared the hell out of me. I don't know what it is for you. And so I knew I had to find an answer. And I thought about it for a while, and I thought, Lord, you know, what'll I do? What'll I do? And I remembered one more time of reading something in the Bible. And so I went back into the Bible. And I'm thinking, you know, what I remembered was that it said something to this extent. It was in red. And we know that when anything's in the Bible, it's in red, it's God talking. Because I was taught that in Sunday school. And it went something like this. I have created man in my image. And for man, I have made woman. And woman is to follow man. And I thought about that for a little while, you know, and I thought, well, now, damn, I followed three of you sons of bitches, and look where I ended up at. You know, Nut House and Alcoholics Anonymous, so something was wrong somewhere. So I got back into the Bible, and sure enough, I found it in two different places in the Bible. And it did. It said what I thought it said. It says, I have created man in my image, and for man I have made woman. And woman is to follow man, and man follows God. You see, I had never finished reading the instructions, the story of my life. And so what I did is I sat down and I took an inventory on this particular problem. And I went back over it and I looked at the kind of men that I had married. And let me see if you girls can identify with this. He had charm, polish, and prestige. After all, that was only befitting, right? We deserve that. He was good-looking, fun-loving, party-going, hard-drinking, woman-chasing. God, what a challenge. Ooh, you know, and I got him. God damn near killed me, but I got him. Oh, and how we love that. I see you guys sitting over there laughing. Yeah, y'all do the same thing. What, you know, some of you come to me to talk about this relationship. Oh, God, how I love that word. That's all we hear anymore is about these relationships. And you'll start talking to me about her, you know, and I'll say, well, what is there about her, you know, that you like? I get that blank look. Like? I said, yeah, you know, what's there about her? There must be something about her.
She's got these big boobs.
You girls are sitting there laughing. Let me tell you the answers I've got out of you. I'll say, do you respect him? Respect him? You know, I get that blank look again, you know. I'll say, yeah, you know, what is there about him? You respect him. What is there? Well, he turns me off. He's got such cute buns. I mean, that's the going thing to guys. You got to have cute buns today. Respect, like, I'd never heard of those words myself. I mean, that thought never occurred to me. He turned me on, you know, that challenge, that potential. Oh, God, how many times have I heard that word? They've got such potential. You know, there's another thing that bothers me, too, and I might as well get that out of my crawl here while I'm here. I hear people get up at this podium and say, well, today I no longer have a drinking problem. I've been sober now for X number of days, months, or years, and I just have a living problem. Oh, God. If somebody says something like that to you, for Christ's sake, run! I've got living problems today. You damn right I have. I'm alive today, and I'm living. But the day I walked in these doors, over 22 years ago, I came here because I was dying from alcoholism. The day I ever forget that alcohol is my problem is the day this girl's lobbled me back on the juice again. I don't want to ever forget that. Anyway, now that I've got that over with, I do talk about problems. But always keep in mind, you see, because our book tells us that if we want to get over drinking, that there has to be a transformation of thought and feeling. There has to be.
And the way we go about doing this is through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because those steps are our spiritual steps. And I found out by reading that book that it says that there is three conditions before we can even begin to take those steps. Have you decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it? Three conditions. Made the decision, want what we have, and the kicker is go to any length to get it. You see, I was always willing to go to any length to get it until it come time to pay the price. And then I wasn't too willing. But I learned that that's what I had to do, because only at that point then are we ready to take these steps. And I'm involved in this, and I'm telling you, I'm up to the third step by this time with my program. And I open that book up again to that emergency page, because I'm still filled with this problem and I still ain't found my answer. I'm all around it now, but I ain't found the answer yet. So I get back over to my emergency page and I open it back up again. And on page 65, my book told me to go. And in there, it describes me perfectly. It says, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making, and they arise out of ourself. The alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must get rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. Now, I don't know what that does for you, but scared hell out of me. And again, I'm back to fear and pain. And I knew I had to take an action, and I didn't know what that action was. And so I had taken this fourth step now, and I had found out some of my defects of character. And now it was time for me to go to this sponsor of mine and to tell it. And you see, in the fifth step, it says that we must tell all of our life story to someone. All of it. You can't omit anything. Well, there was no way I was going to go to this sponsor and tell her. I had not even told my psychiatrist a couple of things. And now I got to go to this sponsor, because I knew, you see, if I went to her and told her this, she was going to throw me out of her home. And not only that, she was going to come in here to these AA meetings and tell all you people what I had done, and then you were going to ask me to leave. So there was no way I could do this. Now, I have found that there is a message here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that to be a message of love. And I have also found that there is a theme here, and that theme is one drunk working with another. And let me tell you how that came together for me, because I was filled with this fear of going to my sponsor and telling her about these things. And in the book, I went back again, and I found an answer for me that would take away this fear. It says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, your darkest past is the greatest possession you have. For it is the key to life and happiness. And with that key, we avert death and misery for others. God, can you imagine? The worst things you've done is the key to life and happiness. And with that key, we avert death and misery for others. And how I found that I applied in my life was that with this, I was able to go to my sponsor, and I was able to then give her my fourth step. And as we sat there and talked, and I shared with her, and she shared a part of her story with me, we developed a relationship, and it became a relationship of love. And as I began to work with other sober women alcoholics, and they shared their story with me, and I in turn shared a part of my story with them, we also developed a relationship, and in most cases it also became a relationship of love. And isn't love God? And isn't God spiritual? And isn't that what our whole program here in Alcoholics Anonymous all about? And as I close here today, I want to wish for each and every one of you all of the things that I have found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. All of the contentment, all of the anguish, all of the fears and resentments, the joys, the happinesses, the sorrows, the agonies, and the ecstasies. Because you see, these things are life. And I have found life right here with you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.